that is going on in the background, or maybe in the foreground, you do mm-hmm. see it as the start of an accelerated schedule of moon missions.
Oh, yes. The moon is becoming more and more important. NASA's problem in the past is that it's had very few missions to the moon. All its manned projects to the moon have fallen by the wayside. So it really has to up its flight rate to what it had in the 1960s. But of course, the moon is important for many reasons. Trump introduced the Space Force, and the Americans now realize that the moon is important militarily, not because of what you can put on the surface, but because you can use the space around the moon to hide important military satellites and keep them away from the surveillance of the other side. So not only for exploration, for bases, for international cooperation, the moon has become the high frontier for international tension and perhaps conflict in the future.
David Whitehouse, fascinating, the author of The Moon, a biography, and a former consultant to NASA. Thank you very much for bringing us to the end of The Times at One. That's it from me today. Thank you to The Times at One team. I'll be back tomorrow at the same time, next on Times Radio. And joining me here in the studio, it's Asma Mir in for Jane and Fee.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, it is 2 o'clock. You're listening to Asma Mir on Times Radio. Coming up on the show today, the two-child benefit cap comes to an end today while the state pension age rises by a year. I'll be speaking to two experts about whether the government has its priorities right. We'll also hear from a student in the United States who says she's faced harassment after speaking out about an alleged attempt by China to recruit her as a spy. More than 500 members of Britain's military have reportedly shared sensitive locations and personal details via the fitness app Strava. So what will it take to get them to stop? Plus, would you return a stray cat if your neighbour claimed it was actually theirs? First, we'll get the news with James Kitchen.
Thank you, Asma. Good afternoon. Iran has accused the US of destroying the path to diplomacy, warning any ceasefire negotiations are incompatible with ultimatums and threats to commit war crimes. Tehran and Washington have reportedly received a two-tier plan to end the war compiled by Pakistan. It's understood the proposal involves an initial ceasefire before reaching a final agreement to close hostilities. It comes after Donald Trump threatened to strike Iranian critical infrastructure and blow up the whole country if the regime failed to open the Strait of Hormuz by tomorrow evening. The head of the Center for International Policy think tank, Nancy O'Kale, told Times Radio a resolution is possible but won't be immediate.
For this war to end and for the strait to be opened, this requires a political understanding rather than a military pressure. And we've seen this like throughout the past 5 weeks or so, where every time Trump threatens with more escalation, Iran escalates as well.
Meanwhile, Israel says it's hit the major Iranian petrochemical site at South Pars. The IDF has also revealed it's killed the Iranian Revolutionary Guard's head of intelligence, Majid Hademi. A number of benefits and the state pension are rising as the new financial year begins, including more funding for larger families on universal credit. The two-child benefit cap has now been scrapped, meaning some 480,000 families with three or more children will receive an average rise of £4,100 a year. HuffPost political editor Kevin Schofield says the changes may placate rebellious Labour backbenchers for now.
The talk of removing Keir Starmer after the elections in May, that seems to have died away a little bit, I think perhaps partly because of the geopolitical situation. A lot of Labour MPs now think it would just be the wrong time to try and change prime ministers when things are so up in the air around the world. He is seen as being more comfortable, certainly on the global stage.
Police are going door to door and examining CCTV footage as part of a murder investigation in Glasgow. Craig Hamilton was found dead at a property in Castlemilk on Thursday. He was last seen 5 days before that. PayPal is the latest sponsor to distance itself from London's Wireless Festival over the booking of Kanye West as headliner. It's understood the company will no longer feature on any future promotional materials for the event. There's been a backlash to the rapper's booking because of his previous anti-Semitic rhetoric on social media. Pepsi and Diageo have already pulled their sponsorship. Four astronauts are just hours away from reaching a part of space never explored before. The crew of Artemis 2 will be flying past the dark side of the moon at around 11:45 tonight UK time. James Carpenter is from the European Space Agency.
Ultimately, the plan is to be able to ferry people to the moon very regularly on a safe basis. And who knows, perhaps even tourists will be fortunate one day to visit the moon. And of course, we would like that to be safe, just as air travel is today.
For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Hello, good afternoon. This is Asma Mir sitting in for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover all week. Now, it is a new financial year. The pensions have risen, but so has the pension age, and the two-child benefit cap has been scrapped, among other changes. Who does this help? And is the money being spent in the right places? Also on the programme, we're going to speak to the Stanford student who says that China tried to recruit her as a spy after yesterday's bizarre post from Donald Trump. Where are we today when it comes to Iran and any potential ceasefire? Plus, everything you need to know on books, money and tech. And do please get in touch. It'd be lovely to read your texts and WhatsApps again. The text number is 87222. And the WhatsApp number is 0333 00032353. Or you can always send an email as well. It's studio@times.radio. Let's have a look at the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. Number three, the Waitrose worker who took on an Easter egg thief sacked after 17 years. This is Walker Smith, who's 54, worked at a branch in Clapham Junction in London. He said that he was let go after trying to snatch a bag full of lint eggs. It's very specific, isn't it, from a shoplifter. And obviously that is a story that has been interesting you. The second most read story, she took in a stray cat. 2 years later, police came knocking. Fur flies in France over Pompon, the moggy, which turned up in a barn without a microchip and made himself at home. We're going to be covering that story a bit later on. But the most read piece on the Times website, unsurprisingly, is the Iran war. Latest US-Israeli strike kills Iranian intelligence chief. This is Majid Khademi, who's been assassinated as Washington and Tehran are said to have received a peace plan for a 45-day ceasefire and to open the Strait of Hormuz. You can read all those articles, of course, at thetimes.com. You'll need your digital subscription, and if you don't have one, you can get one. Just go to thetimes.com/subscribe. And if you already are a subscriber, it's not just those articles you can read. There's lots of stuff on there. There's a full archive, including the in-depth interviews from the weekend's papers. Over the last couple of days, for example, there's been a few revealing interviews with Julian Lloyd-Webber and Brian Cox. If you want to read those, plus all the features from the Saturday and Sunday Times, just head to our website or app and check them out. Right, we're going to talk financial matters now, really, because major changes to welfare and pensions come into force today, which will be felt by millions of households. I wonder if either of these affect you. The two-child benefit cap has been lifted, a move that campaigners say could reduce child poverty. But at the same time, the state pension age has risen to 67, meaning that many people will have to wait longer before they can retire. The government says this is part of a broader effort to balance the public finances and target support where it's most needed. But if ministers can't afford to do everything, which is always the case, is it not? Have they made the right choices about who wins and who loses? Let's speak to two people now, to the Director of Policy Research and Impact at the Trussell Trust, Helen Barnard. Hi, Helen.
Hello.
And the former Pensions Minister, Baroness Ros Altman. Hi to you, Ros.
Hi there.
Helen, let me start with you then, first of all. The scrapping of the two-child benefit cap, much discussed. What difference will that make and when will it be felt?
So I think the backdrop to this is we've seen millions more people facing hunger in the last few years. And that rise has been especially for families with children and especially for families with three or more children. We got to a point where 4 in 10 of those families were facing hunger. So, and the single biggest driver of that increased child poverty and that severity of hardship was the two-child limit. So lifting it means that more than 600,000 people, including more than 400,000 children, will be protected from severe hardship. And we know that it's so important for children to be able to have a good start in life if they're going to do well at school, if they're going to develop, if they're going to become eventually kind of workers in our economy and pay for the next generation's pensions. And this policy change is going to give so many families just a decent shot at giving their kids the start that we all want to see.
And when will the kind of the financial benefit of that be felt by these families?
It will be very soon. So the policy goes on the 6th of April. So families who are currently have a third child and are not getting support will be able to get that support. And as other families come through the system, they will be able to get support. And we've seen the impacts of this at food banks. I was in a food bank a couple of weeks ago. They said they were literally counting down the days till this went, because they see so many families just at the end of their tether, not able to afford the basic essentials for their children, and what a difference this will make.
You'll know the opposing argument, which is that lifting the cap adds pressure to public finances, which are already stretched. But I wonder, I mean, I presume that you know, what one supports and what doesn't support when it comes to moving money around, I don't know, perhaps just depends on your own personal circumstances and for whom you feel empathy and for whom you don't. I mean, we've already have, Helen, some texts coming in from people who perhaps aren't affected by this, who believe that this is the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously people will have different views, but I think actually as a society, there is something important about saying we are going to collectively try and make sure all of our kids get a decent start in life. And on the financial side, some research that we did a little while ago quantified the additional spending that was having to go into things like the NHS, because living and growing up in this kind of severe hardship does incredible damage to people's health, to their physical health and their mental health. That adds pressure to public services and actually pushes people further away from the labour market. So it goes against the endeavour to try and get more people back into work. If we're leaving people with so little money, they can't afford food or a bus fare or to run essential medical equipment.
Mm. I'll come back to you in a second. Ros Altman, I mean, you know, you're very well versed in the arguments pro and against the pension age going up and triple lock, et cetera, et cetera. State pension rising, but so does the age at which people can claim it. But people are living longer. So is working longer reasonable or not?
Well, of course, if you are able to work longer, it can be of benefit both to you and to the economy and also to employers to have loyal workers with lots of life experience. The problem we've got in this country is that we have a massive differential in healthy life expectancy. So a lot of people, especially those who've had, let's say, heavy manual labour lives in their early careers, are not healthy in their early 50s, and they are being told they have to wait ever longer because the average person is living longer. They may not be at all, and the most advantaged groups actually stay healthy into their early 70s now. So for them, it's not a problem at all, but there's no allowance in the state pension starting age for how your state of health is, or even how many years of national insurance you've contributed. Because after 35 years of NI, you get a full state pension. And many of these people who are not yet in their mid-60s may have almost 50 years of NI contribution, but get no extra help because of it.
Mm. What then would... Do you think that there needs to be something kind of written into the system that... that not discriminates, but that, you know, it's not a kind of a one size fits all, that yeah, there needs to be some kind of wriggle room. I mean, I'm not sure how that would work, but I presume that's what you think, that's what you'd like to see.
I definitely think that the age of one size fits all does not fit 21st century Britain. And as I say, there's a near 20 year differential in healthy life expectancy across the country. That isn't going to disappear. What we need, in my view, is to look not just at chronological age, which penalises the least advantaged people and is much better for those who are fitter, healthier and generally wealthier than others. And maybe instead of pretending that 35 years of NI is a full working life, which clearly it isn't, we should extend the number of years required for a full state pension to something that is more realistic. You know, if someone started work, as many of the people in their 60s now did, at age 16, some maybe even 15, but certainly 16 or 18, they've done their 35 years by their early 50s. Mm. And yet they can't get a penny of state pension, even if they're terminally ill. Now, something seems to be going awry when the people who can't work longer are still told that they can't have a penny of state pension for their retirement when they genuinely are too ill, too old in their terms to actually keep working. Mm. That doesn't do anybody any good. And actually, I think the mark of a more understanding and modern welfare system should be able to take account, at least in a better way than we do now, of individual differences.
Helen, can I come back to what we were talking about earlier? Because, you know, since we've had a discussion, and I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear this, there are, you know, a lot of people getting in touch saying, actually, the two-child benefit cap was a good thing because I'm paraphrasing here, if you can't afford to feed more than two children, then you probably shouldn't. And that worked as some kind of disincentive. What would you say to that?
I think it's probably two things. One is that we have essentially done an experiment on the nation's children and established that it doesn't act as a disincentive. It doesn't change people's behaviour. Mm. And that really leads to the second thing, which is we all know that life can change. So if you're a family where you've got two parents in work, you have three children, you are completely able to afford that. And then one of you gets sick and can't work as many hours. It cannot be right that that family is then left with no option but to turn to a food bank. But that was the system that we had created. I mean, I remember a mother who I worked with for a long time who had three kids, had been in a kind of good job, husband in a good job. She then found herself in a position of domestic abuse. She fled with the children and then also became ill and disabled. And she found herself unable to afford food and other essentials and having to turn to food banks. There is no world in which that is a compassionate, fair or logical system to be imposing on the nation's children.
You said earlier that the experiment has been carried out, but I mean, has it? Was it long enough for us to work out whether it was a disincentive or not?
Yes, I mean, the two-child limit was in place for years. I mean, I remember before it was brought in, there was plenty of research and analysis trying to look at would we expect it to have any effect on behaviour? And the conclusion then was that probably not, given what we know about how other changes to the system had or hadn't affected people. It was brought in anyway, and we have conclusively established it did nothing. So it did nothing for work because most of the families affected or already have someone in work. It did nothing to change if someone has a baby because people don't have babies or not because of the benefits system and because, as I said, life changes. All it did was to drive hundreds of thousands of families into severe hardship and condemn a generation of children to grow up in families facing hunger and hardship that will hold them back for the rest of their lives, potentially. It really did. That policy achieved none of its aims. All it did was to make families much, much poorer and drive them to the doors of food banks.
I'm interested, Helen, before I go back to Roz, what do you think of what Roz has said about, and she's not necessarily making this point, but, you know, we are looking at two kind of issues. One is children and families, which will benefit from the changes, and pensioners who won't necessarily. I mean, you can say, yes, it's rising because of inflation, the triple lock, et cetera, but that, you know, the state, the age is going up. And so it's going to take people longer before they can actually claim it. Do you think that that's fair or unfair?
I mean, I think there are two things, as Ros was saying. One is that the pension system was never designed to provide an income for 20 years of life or 30 years after you've stopped work. Mm. That's not what anybody would have envisaged. But that is what, for people who are lucky enough to have good health, that is what's now happening. And so there is a logic to the idea that as healthy life expectancy goes up, it makes sense to have the pension age gradually going up. However, as Ross said, the difficulty we've got is these stark inequalities. And actually, some of it, I think, comes back to the fact that the working age benefit system, things like universal credit, are set so low, people can't even afford food and other essentials. So the kind of penalty you get if you get ill in your 50s, as Ross says, and can't work, is enormous. And what we see is once people cross that magic line into, say, pension, by and large, they move out of poverty, not in all cases, not if they're still renting necessarily. But isn't the problem that, you know, wherever you put the state pension age, if the system you're in before it is so bad that you're driven into hunger into a food bank, that's a bad place for anybody to be, whether you're in your 30s having children or whether you're in your 50s, you've become unwell and you can't work anymore.
Yeah.
The problem is the nature of that system.
Now, Ros, I don't want to pitch this as a kind of us versus them, although, you know, a lot of people, whenever they talk about pensions specifically, they talk about, you know, the young paying for pensions and why give money to kind of pensioners who are well off because they've worked all their lives and they're some of them are already on the property ladder, et cetera, et cetera. What's your own feeling about the lifting of the two-child benefit cap?
To be quite honest, I have concerns about lifting it without any other limit. I always thought two children is a bit mean, if you like. Mm. And in terms of demographics, we would want couples to be encouraged to have at least, say, three. But what we're finding here is that there is no limit on the cap. So the kind of decisions that you were talking about that people in work would have to make once they have, let's say, three children, can we afford another one and another one, are not necessarily needed to be made by those who are not in work or who are working but only one of the parents or in a very low paid job. Mm. So what I think is essential is that we have a proper analysis of the extra costs of having, you know, the marginal extra cost, if you like, as an economist, I would be calling it, of having one more child, which is not a multiple directly of the cost of one child. So once you've had one, the extra costs of two, three, four, five, six, etc., do not go up by just a multiple of the cost of one, because you can share costs, you can share food costs, you can buy in bulk. You know, there are lots of ways in which you have less expenditure on clothing and all sorts of other areas. I don't think we have really built that into our system yet. And I do think that there is going to come a point where the people who are working and making decisions about what they can afford could start feeling resentful. And you don't want that in any society. It's the same as young people seeing pensioners getting an increase and forgetting that what pensioners are actually living on is about the lowest state pension in the developed world. We're not talking about a king's ransom. Yes, compared with ordinary poverty levels, the state pension is around the level that just brings people over if they haven't got any other income. But some pensioners will have much higher expenditure. They have to pay a lot more on heating. They can't get out in the way they would like to. So they're much more at home and they have less fuel efficient homes as well. So there are lots of ways in which our system seems to look at one size fits all for different groups of people,
right,
who have differences within those groups.
Of course. Baroness Ros Altman, thank you very much, former pensions minister. And we also heard from Helen Barnard, who is the Director of Policy Research and Impact at the Trussell Trust. I know that there's a lot of you who have a lot to say about this. Just very quickly, Kay says we only ever had the number of children we thought we could afford. Richard, this is rubbish. People need to plan and consider things going wrong and save. Why is it the state that has to cover, except as a complete backstop? Let me know what you think. All views are welcome. 87222, start your message with the word Times. Or you can WhatsApp us, 0333 003 2353, or send an email, studio@times.radio. In case you're wondering, this is Asma Mayor on Times Radio, sitting in for Jane and Fee. And coming up, if you discovered your adopted stray cat was in fact your neighbour's, would you return it? It's 2:23.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio.
Prepare for a lively mix of illuminating conversation, telling the stories that matter, alongside a world-class lineup of guests, experts and contributors. There's a merry band of erudite intellectuals who join us every evening. Michael Binion.
We had a very interesting meeting with the Russian Orthodox Patriarch.
Zoe Strimple.
There is real unease.
And Peter Hitchens, to name a few.
This is war, for goodness sake. Nobody tells the truth about what's going on.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
At Tesco, we know that beans...
Mains Heinz.
And you love to ask.
Have you had yours?
All of you.
Love it.
Hate it.
And because...
I'm worth it.
When you need low prices on brands you love, like 150 grams of Heinz beans, 12-pack of Weetabix, 250 grams of Marmite, or 700 millilitres of L'Oreal Elvive Colour Protect Shampoo, look out for the Everyday Low Prices logo in-store and online. Tesco. Every little helps. Everyday low prices includes thousands of products across the majority of larger stores and online prices held until the 10th of May. Selected branded products only.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Right, it is 2:25. This is Asma Mir sitting in for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover all this week. And coming up after 3:30, the literary editor of The Times and The Sunday Times, Robbie Millen, will be here to tell us what he's been reading. And every week on this show, you hear fantastic interviews with brilliant guests. And if you miss it, don't worry, you can listen to it on Jane and Fee's hit podcast, Off Air. You can hear all of their 3:30 interviews in full. Nancy Birtwistle, Carol Vorderman, David Baddiel and Jenny Godfrey. Now, recently they spoke to Thangam Debonair, who is now the CEO of the UK Opera Association. And she told Jane and Fee what she thought about Timothy Chalamet's comments that opera and ballet are dying art forms.
First off, the thing was, it just wasn't true. I mean, opera and ballet are very much still with us. And the art form that is ballet, actually, let's widen it out into dance. Dance is in so many people's lives in so many different ways. And, you know, I'm on the board of Sadler's Wells, for instance, and I know that the range of dance that we put on, that to packed houses very often, but also people who you might not expect being in a theatre watching live dance and live ballet, is extraordinary. And it's thriving and it's developing and it's taking on new forms that wouldn't have existed even 50 years ago. Opera similarly, the sheer range of work that's happening in opera is extraordinary. And I think he was acting for his own reasons.
That was Thangam Debonair. You can download that and many, many other episodes wherever you get your podcasts from. Right, we're going to go to France now, where a cat has found itself at the centre of an escalating legal battle. Amy Raclo found two cats in her barn a couple of years ago. One of the pair was returned to a neighbour who said that both cats were hers. But mysteriously, hopefully we'll be able to shed some light on this, Raclo kept one and registered him under another name, her own name. Now that neighbour is accusing Raclo of theft. The pair will appear in court this month to decide the pet's fate. Adam Sage, Times reporter based in Paris, has been covering this story, which has piqued a lot of interest amongst the cat lovers in this country. Hi, Adam.
Hello.
Can you just explain, the neighbour obviously knew that she'd lost two cats, but only took one back. Why?
Well, it's mysterious. I mean, the neighbour hasn't talked to the media, only her lawyer has. What happens is that these two cats turned up in Emile Raclo's barn. It's in a little village called Augicourt in eastern France a couple of years ago. She took them to the vet, who looked at them, said one had a microchip and the other didn't. And because of the microchip, was able to identify the owner and took them back. To the neighbour who was their owner, who said, yeah, both the cats are mine, except that they both came back, I think, something like 8 days later in the barn, And at that point, I think Emmy Hacklow took them back to the vet yet again. And the vet said, well, you know, the one with the microchip, we better give it back to the neighbour. Mm. But why don't you keep all, or this is Emmy Hacklow's version of it, you know, we don't really know what to do about the other one. And she said, well, I'm going to keep it. And she did. Mm. And essentially nothing happened for several months, 18 months. I mean, the cat, who she calls Pom Pom.
Of course she does.
That's her name. It's quite a common cat's name in France, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, he just stayed with her. It seems she says very happy. I mean, it goes into the courtyard, it suns itself. Happily, when there's a bit of sun around, it's fed, it's pampered. She says that she spent €800 in vets fees on the cat, and she's had a microchip fitted that identifies her as an owner. So all seemed to be well and good until she got a message from the neighbour saying, slightly bizarrely, and I don't really understand this, that the neighbour said that her daughter was going to Spain and would like to take the cat with her, and could Emmy Hacklow give it back? She said no.
It seems very convenient. It's almost, I mean, obviously I don't know the ins and outs of the case, and we will find out. But it does feel a bit like she wasn't that bothered. But then when her daughter said, "Oh, I'm going to Spain. I quite like the cat," she said, "Oh yes, I'll just go fetch it."
I'd say we're getting a lot of the version from Emmy Hacklow, who's absolutely indignant about this, and all the more so because when she said there's no way you're taking that cat to Spain, it's staying with me, the neighbours then went to court, filed a lawsuit accusing her of theft. And a few months later, she got a letter in a letterbox from the police, and she said, you know, when her husband went to open the letterbox and said that we've got a letter from the police here, and she didn't know what it was. She opened it and she found out that it was accusing her of theft of the cat, and that she'd been summoned to court. So that's where things stand now.
Right. Well, we will definitely check back in on the story. I'm dying to know what the judge is going to decide next month. Adam, thank you very much for that. It's Adam Sage, Times reporter based in Paris. You can read that story in the Times, actually. And if you have any experience of that particular thing happening, do get in touch. How was it all sorted out? 87222, start your message with the word Times. Coming up, we're going to discuss the risks of exposing China's espionage tactics. This is with someone who says she was directly targeted as they tried to recruit her as a spy. But first, on Times Radio at 2:31, let's get the headlines with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Asma. Good afternoon. Iran says it won't open the Strait of Hormuz as part of a potential temporary ceasefire with the United States. The demands included in a proposal from Egyptian, Pakistani and Turkish mediators, which would reportedly pause fighting for 45 days. Donald Trump's threatened to blow up Iranian bridges and power plants if the key shipping lane isn't reopened by tomorrow night. The military expert, Professor Michael Clark, says he doubts a comprehensive deal can be reached.
My guess would be that this proposal won't consist of all that much from the American point of view. I mean, President Trump is looking for a way out, and I think he'll settle for forms of words which won't stand too much scrutiny, but will be enough to get him out, to declare victory and leave. That's clearly what he wants to do.
Meanwhile, Israel's confirmed its forces have killed Iran's head of intelligence, Majid Hademi. The Israeli military has also attacked the country's South Pars gas complex. Elsewhere, ministers insist changes to the benefits system introduced today will help millions of workers. They include the right to statutory sick pay from the first day of illness and the scrapping of the two-child benefit cap. Three men have been arrested on suspicion of murder after a man was attacked outside a bar in Bournemouth. The victim, who was in his 40s, died at the scene this morning. It's understood PayPal will no longer appear on any future promotional materials for London's Wireless Festival. It's the latest company to distance itself from the event following the controversial booking of Kanye West as headliner. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
Tesco Insurance are driving down the cost of motoring with 10% off car insurance. Take out a car insurance policy before the 15th of May 2026 and you'll get 10% off with club card prices. We offer a range of cover options so you can choose the one that's right for you. Save 10% when you buy or renew a car policy with Tesco Insurance. Search Tesco Car Insurance and get a quote direct today. Club card required. Excludes add-ons. T's and C's apply.
You're listening to Times Radio, where conversation goes beyond the headlines. When it comes to advertising, is your business showing up in environments where it's taken seriously? Or are you relying on word of mouth alone? Join us at the Times Radio advertising event in May. You'll receive a custom campaign for your business, event-only prices, and free creative designed to reflect the quality of your brand. Register now at newsrsvp.co.uk/radio. Stop relying on word of mouth alone and start being heard.
Right now, a guide dog puppy is taking her very first steps. One day, she'll help someone with sight loss live a full and independent life.
Find the crossing, Bess. Good girl.
When you sponsor a puppy with guide dogs, you're there for it all. Her wobbly walks, her first harness, the life-changing partnership. It's more than a donation. It's the start of a life-changing story. Search Sponsor a Guide Dog Puppy and be part of a story you'll be proud to share.
Guide dogs.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
And Carol Walker herself is presenting Times Radio Drive this afternoon, and she's here to tell us what you've got coming up. Are we going to be able to top Donald Trump's post yesterday, do you think? Because he's going to be speaking later on, isn't he?
Yeah. I found that President Trump likes to come on my shows, actually. He frequently comes on my late show, often unannounced, pops up and decides to talk for quite some time. Look, we've got him delivering a news conference, an update due at 6 o'clock. We know these things can be a bit fluid. And I think it will be fascinating to see what tone he adopts, because he has faced quite a backlash for that post on Truth Social, where he talked about openly effing Strait of Hormuz and used the sort of language that I think even some other senior world leaders have been shocked by. Certainly former diplomats that I've talked to have said it's just not the sort of language you would expect. And I'm not sure that it actually gives the sense of a leader who's in charge of what's happening or even feels confident of his position.
Do you think it's just that it's just finally his patience just breaking? Is that what it was? Because why else would you, and where'd you go from? You can't say anything worse than that, can you? Or maybe you can, I don't know.
Trying to read the mind and the motivations of President Trump.
That's your job.
Is not the easiest of tasks. Look, I think that there certainly is a sense in which the White House believes that, yes, there may be the prospect of some sort of negotiations. And we're hearing that Pakistan is trying to broker some kind of ceasefire to allow for proper talks to take place. But that maximum pressure can and should go alongside that. Or as Pete Hegseth, the war secretary, put it the other day, you know, we negotiate with guns. I mean, that may be a crude way of putting it, but certainly, I mean, it is a very frequently used negotiating position to put maximum pressure on as you go into talks, because in the hope that that gives you the upper hand in negotiations. Whether putting out a social media post using that sort of language does anything to actually convince the enemy of your strength, I'm not at all convinced. But I think certainly the language that the president uses and what he says, if he's tackled about that, will be absolutely fascinating. On the programme tonight, we're going to be finding out more about Pakistan's role in trying to broker some kind of talks on this with Moeed Yousif, who's a former national security advisor in Pakistan. We're also going to be talking with the brilliant Karen von Hippel, who's a
a former State Department official. She used to be director of the Royal United Services Institute, and someone who brings real insight into what is going on, not just in the White House, but the State Department and elsewhere. And we'll also be hearing from a former US Marine Corps official, Jonathan Hackett, who's written various books about Iran, just trying to get a handle on what's happening on all sides of this. Lots of other stories, of course, coming up on Drive this afternoon. I don't know about you, but I was quite shocked about these latest figures on the deaths of women during childbirth. Mm. That the Times has been analysing. We'll talk to Kim Thomas of the Birth Trauma Association about all of that. And we're going to have the MP from Britain's fattest town, Ebbw Vale, to hear about what they're trying to do to tackle the tide of obesity and junk food shops.
Exactly. The takeaways and the junk food ads do not help, but it's a fascinating story. We're going to be covering that too. Carol, thank you so much. Carol Walker will be here sitting in for John Pienaar with Drive at 4 o'clock. Right, it is now 2:38. Now, last August, a Stanford student wrote about how the Chinese Communist Party had attempted to recruit her as a spy during her second year at college. Since then, Elsa Johnson says she's received threatening messages and phone calls from Mandarin speakers, and the FBI have warned her that China is monitoring her day-to-day movements on campus. In testimony to the US Congress last week, she warned that universities in America aren't doing enough to support students who are victims of espionage. And we can speak to Elsa now. Hello, Elsa.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, just explain, since you spoke out, what has been happening? What kind of messages and phone calls have you been receiving? What do they say?
Yeah, so I started receiving a lot of phone calls this past summer when I was working in Washington, D.C., and they often begin in English and then they switch to Mandarin. And in one case, a caller referenced my mother, and in another instance more recently, after I'd gotten back from dinner with my family, I got a phone call where the caller asked me whether or not I had finished eating dinner in Mandarin. So it was really scary.
Goodness me. So what do you think is actually going on? I mean, in what way do you think they're monitoring you or watching you? What do you think is happening?
Yeah, so when I talked to the FBI, they implied that they have people following me around on campus. I personally haven't really, you know, noticed anyone following me, but I think that's sort of what's happening. And I think it's an attempt to threaten me, and it's an attempt to stop me from doing my journalism.
Mm. Now, without going into too much detail, because it's quite a long and complex story, although it's incredibly fascinating, can you just explain to listeners who perhaps don't know how this happened, why do you think you were targeted?
I think I was targeted because I grew up going to a Chinese immersion school. I'm studying U.S.-China relations. And at the time I was targeted, it was because I was also studying Chinese military tactics and industry. So I think that was definitely a draw to try to get me to go to China and, you know, offering to pay and trying to offer incentives for me to spend time in China.
Mm. And this was an individual who you thought perhaps went to the same college as you because of mutual friends that you had on social media, got in touch with you, trying to recruit you, trying to pay for stuff, etc. At what point did you, I mean, did some of you, did part of you as a kind of journalist want to kind of go along with this to see where it would lead, or did you cut this off very, very early on?
Yeah, I think I very early on was super suspicious. And then I wanted to keep the conversation going just out of curiosity. And I ended up documenting every interaction I had with him. Mm. Because, you know, early on in our conversation, he asked me in Mandarin if I spoke Chinese, and I had no idea how he would know that.
Mm. Has this happened to anyone else that you know?
Yeah, it's actually happened to at least 10 other women who, you know, I've gotten in touch with, and many of them are interested in similar things.
And what is the, I mean, I know you didn't get that far, but do you understand how these things work? I mean, clearly, so they want you to spy, and do you have any idea what they would give you in return?
Yeah, it's hard to say exactly. I think what they'll often use as an incentive is money and, you know, fame in China. I think they sort of offer, you know, status and money, and eventually it becomes a lot more threatening. If you refuse to comply, they might start threatening your family or using information you've shared with them against you.
Mm. Now, in testimony to the US Congress last week, you said that universities in America aren't doing enough to support students who are victims of espionage. I think this is there's a couple of things here. The first thing is, I suppose, it's the ethics of perhaps financial gifts that are offered or et cetera, and to universities. Explain why you think there might be an ethical tension there.
Yeah, I think there's a huge incentive not to address the issue. A lot of international students, the vast majority of them pay full tuition, which is a lot of money at Stanford. So I think, you know, Stanford would really rather not do anything about this. And you know, international students also bring in a lot of research and ultimately a lot of money for the university. And I think, you know, Stanford wants to keep admitting as many international students as possible.
But you say, to try to be fair to Stanford, you say that you think they would rather not do anything about it, but they did help you, didn't they?
No, they didn't. After I published my first article, they sent an email saying they could, you know, maybe put me in touch with someone, but not me personally. It was, you know, me as a journalist. I had help from the Hoover Institution, which, you know, is Stanford affiliated, and they were really helpful. But the administration itself hasn't reached out to me about being monitored on campus or anything like that.
And you think that's a purely financial decision?
I'm not sure exactly why they won't offer me some sort of help. I think that sort of goes beyond the financial incentive. I think it would be pretty easy for them to reach out to me. I just am not sure they even have the infrastructure to help me.
There are various bits of legislation that are kind of in the ether that might help. Just explain again to our listeners in the UK, what new rules, what legislation might help to make this not happen as frequently as it perhaps is?
Yeah, I honestly don't even think this issue needs to be legislated. I think individual universities can decide to address the issue. They can set up, you know, a tip line, a reporting system for these, you know, situations. And, you know, legislation-wise, I think the Deterrent Act is really important. It lowers the reporting requirement for Section 117 education funding. So any funding to a university from China would have to be reported.
Yeah.
I think that kind of transparency is really important.
You said that you feel that you're being monitored. Do you think you're being monitored right now?
Well, I hope not. But it's hard to say because the FBI didn't give me a lot of details, and based on some of the threatening calls I received, it seems like there are people watching me sometimes. But I try not to think about it, and I don't want it to stop me from reporting.
So have you changed your behavior in any way in terms of, you know, your kind of online security, what you're doing, where you're going? Have you changed your what you do on a day-to-day basis at all?
Yeah, I think I definitely, you know, I'm careful, more careful on social media. I use encrypted messaging services. I am a lot more careful on campus, you know, always making sure my blinds are closed so that people can't see into my room, that kind of thing.
Okay, Elsa, well, it's a pretty chilling story, and thank you very much for telling us about it. We'll keep in touch with you, because who knows what the next kind of stage of this particular story is. Thanks so much for talking to us. That's Elsa Johnson, who's a Stanford student who was approached by Chinese intelligence. It is now at 2:47. Coming up, would you still show off your 5K personal best, even if it meant revealing your secret location?
Global events.
There are real worries about security, about human rights.
Keeping you informed as events unfold.
We are going to be asking a question that would have been unimaginable 48 hours ago.
Reactive analysis.
The scandal here is that of misconduct in a public office. That's the claim here.
From the world's best journalists.
This is what you get. Big thoughts from people with big brains.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
Right now, a guide dog puppy is taking her very first steps. One day, she'll help someone with sight loss live a full and independent life.
Find the crossing, Bess. Good girl.
When you sponsor a puppy with guide dogs, you're there for it all. Her wobbly walks, her first harness, the life-changing partnership. It's more than a donation. It's the start of a life-changing story. Search Sponsor a Guide Dog Puppy and be part of a story you'll be proud to share.
Guide dogs. Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
And there's a lot of you getting in touch, not just about pensions, but about all sorts of stuff. And I will keep trying to read those out. It's nice to know that you're out there, you're engaging and you're sending in messages. You can text 87222, start your message with the word Times. You can email studio@times.radio, or you can WhatsApp on 0333 003 2353. Now, I just want to tell you quickly before we go to tech news about a fantastic event that you won't want to miss. How should Europe respond to a rapidly changing world where peace seems no longer to be the norm? On May the 7th, you can watch a panel discuss defence and whether the West can really cope with a multi-front crisis in Iran. Kate Gerbeau, Mark Galliotti, Mark Urban and Oliver Moody will bring all their experience, insight and analysis. And for tickets to that event on May the 7th, just head to thetimes.com/events. That's thetimes.com/events. And that event is on May the 7th. So don't miss that. Now, this is kind of tongue in cheek, but I'm sure some of you do this. What lengths would you go to let your friends know gently that you have a new 5K personal best time? Would you text them? Would you share it to your Instagram story? Well, that's fine unless you're in the armed forces, because more than 500 members of Britain's military have publicly shared sensitive locations and personal details to the fitness app Strava, which seems like a bit of a problem. Let's speak to Chris Stokel-Walker, who's a resident tech expert, on this and a few other stories. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Asma.
I mean, surely they would have known, would they, that these were sensitive locations, or did they not?
You would hope that they would, but it's not necessarily the case, it seems. At least maybe they think that it's not a big issue to be able to identify, for instance, as the INE's paper has in this reporting, the individual nuclear submarine that one person is working on based on their running route every single day. But it is, I think, a relatively significant breach. The Ministry of Defence says that they were looking into it and that this is something that they believe might not be as quite as big as it seems. But nevertheless, 100 odd people at our base in Faslane, where our nuclear deterrent is based, using Strava, the running app, to record their routes and be tracked every single day that they run. As you mentioned, more than 500 overall military personnel around these sort of very secretive very tightly monitored nuclear and military sites. The fact that you can even understand and learn a little bit about their habits, I think, is a big old issue.
Yeah, and presumably there are just, you know, there are rules that you sign up to when it comes to confidentiality.
Yeah, and it looks as if this is just an indication of perhaps not thinking that actually this data is important, or not necessarily realising that it is tracked. And, you know, British military personnel are not the only people to fall foul to this. We saw reporting in France in recent weeks about an aircraft carrier that was moving on its way to the Gulf that was able to be tracked because one person on board that vessel would repeatedly run around and record the same thing to the same app.
Oh,
so
dear.
They just kind of did a weird loop across the ocean, which, I mean, is a big problem. And it's one that I think we need to wake up to, not just in terms of if you are a military personnel, but also just anybody needs to know that actually the little breadcrumbs of data that we leave in our daily lives, they are very significant. And if you piece them together, then it becomes a big issue.
And some of them seem to know that what they're doing is not right. As at least 25 of them found logging runs on routes named The Stupid Shall Be Punished and Section 9 Security Breach.
Yeah, I mean, I have some friends who are in the armed forces, and I know that they have a gallows sense of humour around this sort of thing. I think probably there is a reason why they are naming them like that, and a recognition that this is a problem.
Yeah.
The reality is that, you know, if we as journalists are able to identify this, if average people are able to identify this, and it's far from the first, as we've talked about there, the French issue has happened in recent weeks, but I remember I'm now a wizened and old head in the tech world. I remember, you know, this being reported in a similar way for US military personnel 7 or 8 years ago now.
Yes,
of
I remember
running
that.
On their bases. Yeah. It's a huge problem, right?
And this is not completely different. The satellite company Planet Labs is going to withhold images of Iran and the region of conflict in the Middle East on the request of the American government. I suppose that's no surprise. How common is that particular practice?
Actually, surprisingly unusual in this sense. Planet Labs has already been adhering to a delay of some sort, around about 2 weeks, on anything to do with the Middle East. But it was seen as an important source of information for learning about the efficacy of the military action that is going on in the Middle East, and frankly, the damage that is being done on both sides, and trying to unpick which of these two parties that are, you know, in part of this conflict was actually ending up winning here. And so the sudden removal of that, I think, is quite unusual and has really got a lot of people up in arms, because the way that we understand about what is going on in this part of the world, particularly at the minute when the White House doesn't seem quite so forthcoming in terms of giving necessarily minute by minute, hour by hour, or necessarily completely 100% clear updates on the progress of what is going on there. Donald Trump flip-flopping as to whether or not he wants a ceasefire or whether he wants to bomb Iran to hell. You know, it is important that we have that oversight, and a growing number of people are involved in what we call this OSINT world, which is open source intelligence, using these satellite images to try and understand what's going on. But I guess, you know, the argument the US is making here is not just those OSINT individuals are using this, but you have an enterprising army in Iran, and they are very, very tech literate. They have a hugely powerful hacking army. They are probably going to be using this too.
And are there alternatives? Are there other companies who do the same thing?
There are some. So, for instance, there is, in this world, a big company called Maxar, which is also used an awful lot by journalists and other organisations, think tanks as well, to try and understand movements of military and things like that. They haven't been approached in the same way that the US government has approached this firm to say, actually, can you lay off giving access to this sort of data? So certainly there are ways around this. I know that a third company, one called Vantor, has kind of willingly stepped back and said that we will not be showing this sort of thing. But yeah, it does mean that in that information deficit, we do lose some insights.
Just finally and quickly, Elon Musk's company SpaceX on track to become a $1 trillion company in light of its planned public listing. It would also set Musk on the path to become the world's first trillionaire, which is, I think, is exactly the news we need right now. Chris, when's it expected to go public, and what might happen there?
Later this year, we don't know for certain, he has confidentially filed to launch his IPO. Always with these things, you confidentially file and then it ends up leaking, such as the way of life. If we were talking a few weeks ago then, I would have said that this is happening in June. We're not quite so certain now, but I think Musk has this vision of wanting to do this by the middle of the year. It will make him enormously rich, and this is one of the things that is important for him to be able to do this. But I think what is also important is that it allows him to get first to the market to try and offer the idea of buying into an AI company to the general public, because we have two other companies, OpenAI and Anthropic, both lining up and wanting to do similar things. In fact, actually, there is a live debate between executives at OpenAI about the timing of their IPO, whether they should follow Musk in doing this year or if they should lay off next. The problem is they are basically going to break the IPO market, asking for astronomical sums, to the extent that actually, you know, who knows if the market can sustain these big companies launching all at the same time.
And what does it do? I mean, obviously it makes him incredibly rich, but what else does it do for him, do you think?
It gives him credibility. It allows him to say that he is the first person to do this. It brings in a big flow of cash to the company. That is also important. We know SpaceX wants to continue its space exploration as well as its AI endeavours. But more than that, I think it gives him bragging rights to do this. And this is really the problem that we have with the AI race at the minute, is that it's also just a titanic clash of egos. And anytime Elon Musk can get one over on Sam Altman, the OpenAI CEO, he loves to do so. If he can get to an IPO first, then I think he will lord it over Sam Altman for years to come.
Okay, well, we should be watching that, I suppose. We've got no choice, really. Chris, thank you. Chris Stokel-Walker, he's our resident tech expert. And thank you to all of you getting in touch about all sorts of things. On the cats in France, Jennifer, legally, I think the cat belongs to whomever purchased it, and they'd be responsible for reimbursing vet bills. Morally, it's a bit of a mess. And thank you so much to, well, there's loads of you getting in touch, actually, telling me where you're listening to Times Radio. Some of you in fields, all sorts of things. Colin has sent me his fastest 5K from his old running days, 25 minutes and 48, which was faster than me, Colin, so well done.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
It is 3 o'clock. Hello, you're listening to As Mamir on Times Radio, sitting in for Jane and Fee. Still to come, Israel says it has struck a major Iranian petrochemical site. We'll bring you the latest on the tensions in the Middle East. We'll also be joined by the Conservative MP and the former British Army officer Ben Obsijekti to discuss the state of Britain's defence sector. After 3:30, the Times literary editor Robbie Millen will bring us his latest reads. Plus, you're not going to want to miss this. The World Coal Carrying Championships are underway as we speak. It's nothing like a 5K. We're going to catch up with the race director to see how it's all gone down. But first, with the latest news, James Kitchen.
Thank you, Asma. Good afternoon. Iran has accused the US of destroying the path to diplomacy, warning any ceasefire negotiations are incompatible with ultimatums and threats to commit war crimes. Tehran and Washington have reportedly received a two-tier plan to end the war, compiled by Pakistan. It comes after Donald Trump threatened to strike Iranian critical infrastructure and blow up the whole country if the regime failed to open the Strait of Hormuz by tomorrow evening. Tom Rivers is a former ABC News foreign correspondent.
No one is talking about the integration of the motivations and maybe the actions of Israel down the road. If Iran and the U.S. can strike a temporary ceasefire, the straits potentially opened up. What about the question of Israel? What about the question if, quote unquote, peace descends upon that part of the world? Will other countries like the U.K. and other NATO countries get involved with some security measures in that part of the Gulf?
A number of benefits and the state pension arising as the new financial year begins, including more funding for larger families on universal credit. The two-child benefit cap has now been scrapped, meaning some 480,000 families with three or more children will receive an average rise of £4,100 a year. Speaking to Times Radio, Helen Barnard from the Trussell Trust welcomed the change.
We've seen millions more people facing hunger in the last few years. And that rise has been especially for families with children and especially for families with three or more children. We got to a point where 4 in 10 of those families were facing hunger. And the single biggest driver of that increased child poverty and that severity of hardship was the two-child limit.
The Home Secretary is facing growing calls from campaigners and politicians to block Kanye West's UK visa. The rapper's been announced as headliner of Wireless Festival in North London this summer. The booking's been criticised following his recent anti-Semitic remarks and celebration of Nazism. Here's Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson.
The comments that he has made in the past are completely unacceptable and absolutely disgusting. I don't think he should be performing at a music festival, but I can't comment on specific individual cases that will be considered in line with immigration rules.
Pepsi, Diageo and PayPal have pulled their support of the festival. Three men have been arrested on suspicion of murder after a man was attacked outside a bar in Bournemouth. Officers were called to reports of an assault in the early hours of this morning. The victim, who was in his 40s, died at the scene. Two men from the town, aged 37 and 46, and a 34-year-old from Poole, have been detained. The crew of Artemis 2 are just hours away from reaching depths of space never before experienced by humans. The astronauts will be flying past the far side of the moon at 11:45 tonight, UK time, losing communication with Earth. Astronomer Dr. Jennifer Millard told Times Radio the crew will be ready should anything go wrong.
They spend years rehearsing every single possible scenario. So they've got a capsule back down on the ground, which is set up, and they will go into the simulator, and then all of mission control send different signals going off. They'll flash different lights, they'll send different error codes, and they will make sure that the astronauts know what to do in every situation. They've got manuals as well that they can refer to, so they are as prepared as they can possibly be.
For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Hello, good afternoon. This is Asma Mir on Times Radio, sitting in for Jane Garvey and Fee Glover all week. Now, after yesterday's bizarre post from Donald Trump, where are we today when it comes to Iran and any potential ceasefire? The country's fattest town fights back against takeaways and junk food ads. Here's a question for you. Has your business been targeted by scammers who post loads and loads of one-star reviews online? And the literary editor of The Times and The Sunday Times, Robbie Millen, will be here with what he is reading right now. And you can get in touch too. It'll be lovely to read all your texts and your WhatsApps. Again, the text number is 87222. Start that message with the word Times, and the WhatsApp number is 0333 003 2353. You can also email studio@times.radio. It's 3:05. So Donald Trump is set to speak in just a couple of hours after the US and Iran received a ceasefire plan from Pakistan. The US president has repeatedly threatened to hit Iran's civilian infrastructure if it doesn't open the crucial Strait of Hormuz. Fighting is currently ongoing, with Israeli airstrikes hitting an Iranian gas complex and killing the intelligence chief of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Iran has attacked US troops based in Kuwait. Let's speak to two people. First of all, to Greg Karlstrom, who's a Middle East correspondent for The Economist, currently in Qatar. Hello to you, Greg.
Good afternoon.
There have been a few peace plans that have floated around. Some of them had 15 points, some of them had 5 conditions. Do we have any idea what is in this particular ceasefire plan?
This one seems to be a very pared-down version of what we've seen in the past. It would call for an initial truce that might last for several weeks, and then during that time, the United States and Iran would negotiate about a permanent ceasefire. Now, the Americans, as part of this, I think, want to see Iran reopen the Strait of Hormuz during that initial truce, which is one of the reasons why I think people are quite skeptical that this effort is going to succeed. The Iranians see control of the strait as their most powerful card. They see security benefits from that in terms of deterring future wars. They're hoping to turn it into a revenue stream by charging tolls on ships that use the strait. So the idea that they would relinquish that card, reopen the strait, lower energy prices, in exchange for only a temporary truce that might not become a permanent ceasefire, I'm very sceptical that they would go along with that.
Yes, and I do see on some news outlets various attributed comments from people within the Iranian regime saying absolutely not. We won't open the Strait of Hormuz during any kind of temporary ceasefire. That would kind of make us a laughingstock.
Right, exactly. I mean, they have made this the focal point of the war. I don't think it's something they're going to simply hand over. Now, the question that we've all had throughout these, what now, two and a half weeks of supposed talks between the U.S. and Iran is who exactly are the Americans speaking to and how much clout do they have within the Iranian system? The foreign ministry, I don't think, is very closely involved in decision-making right now, which is being handled by the Revolutionary Guard and by various other parts of the Iranian regime. So we don't know exactly how they feel, but they tend to be more hardline on these things. So my suspicion is they're not ready to open the strait at all.
I'm interested as to what you feel about a point of view that some people have raised, that when Donald Trump posts a message threatening to hit civilian power plants and civilian infrastructure, some people say that's a war crime. What's your opinion?
So it depends on the circumstances, right? I think there is a widespread belief that any attacks on that sort of infrastructure would constitute a war crime, and that's not actually correct. Whether or not it is depends on the balance between the military advantage you would expect to receive by carrying out such a strike and the impact on civilians that it would cause. So you can argue that striking an individual power plant or bridge, something like that, might be justified if that bit of infrastructure is vital for the Iranian military. Now, I think there are two big problems with what Donald Trump is talking about. One is that he's not just talking about one power plant. He's talking about knocking out the entire Iranian electric grid. I think that indisputably would be a war crime, doing it at that scale. And then he's also not framing this in terms of military necessity. He's not arguing that these power plants are vital for the Iranian military. He's arguing that if we do this, if we knock out these power plants, we will put pressure on the Iranians and that might force them to make a deal. It might lead them to concede. That isn't allowed under international law to do it for that reason. So if he follows through with the threats that he's made, I think they pretty clearly would constitute war crimes.
Okay. Thank you very much for that, Greg. Really interesting. Greg Karlstrom, Middle East correspondent for The Economist, speaking to us from Qatar. And let's now speak to Gina Abercrombie Winstanley, a Middle East expert, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and a former US ambassador. Hello to you, Gina.
Good morning to you.
What do you think, what do you expect? It's a very difficult question because obviously Donald Trump has moved about a lot, shall we say, diplomatically on this. I mean, he was clearly venting a lot of frustration yesterday in that post on Truth Social where he dropped an F-bomb. But what do you think he might, what kind of tone do you think he might take today?
Well, he is going to give a press conference, I think, in a couple of hours. And he has shown himself to be able to, in the same sentence almost, to say we're winning and we're going to bomb more. So I believe we should expect more of the same. Mixed messaging is his sweet spot, as it were, on a variety of issues, certainly on this war. Someone counted, I think we'd heard 17 separate times that we have either won the war or winning the war at the same time as the complaints about Iran not doing what it should to make it easy for us to wrap up and walk away. So mixed messaging is what I expect in short, perhaps a re-emphasis on the threat he put out there, the impending deadline. But we've already heard him say he expects successful talks to be concluded by the end of today. So
okay. Well, I'm going to come back to that in a second, but just to pursue that point just quickly. I know this happened yesterday, but it's very interesting to hear what you think. I mean, mixed messages. I mean, he said, if Iran don't open the effing Strait of Hormuz, Tuesday would be power plant day, bridge day, all wrapped up in one. To do it or you'll be living in hell. There was another word in there that we can't repeat, and wrapped it up by saying praise be to Allah. Calling it the effing Strait of Hormuz, is that presidential language in your opinion?
Clearly not. It was unfortunate. He showed his frustration, which is also unpresidential in a state of war, and regrettable. I think it sent a signal to the Iranians that they are getting to him, as it were. His frustration that his earliest expectations of a quick wrap-up are not panning out. The Chinese have a saying about riding the tiger. It's easier to get on than to get off. And certainly, I believe both sides might be experiencing this. We cannot underestimate the pressure that is on the Iranian regime, the destruction that is being meted out on the country, on its leadership, on its military and industrial capabilities. Both sides are facing pressure.
Now, on this current potential ceasefire plan that we are led to believe that US and Iran have received from Pakistan, who are kind of in the middle of all of this and trying to negotiate or trying to kind of, you know, be the intermediaries rather. If this is, and again, we're second guessing, you know, if they say, okay, we're good, there's going to be a temporary ceasefire, but you need to open the Strait of Hormuz and Iran are very much minded not to, how likely is it that Donald Trump would accept that?
I believe there are very few people indeed who think that the plan as currently outlined, and of course we haven't seen it ourselves, but is going to get the Iranians to agree. They've been very clear, no temporary ceasefire. They've seen Gaza. Mm. They've seen Lebanon. Ceasefires are not necessarily adhered to, and the points that are there do not appear to bind Israel to them as well. This is the United States agreeing to a ceasefire. So it's highly unlikely. I would be shocked that the Iranians agree to that. Now, there are other ways. You know, they could open the Strait of Hormuz. That doesn't mean they might not still be charging for it, or there might be an immediate unfreezing of assets, something that allows the Iranians to point to their demand of getting compensation for war having been declared on them and the damage that was done from the United States and Israel. So there are some things that might be modified in that could get it to move forward. But certainly immediate relief, economic relief would have to be out there. There would have to be some way that both sides could point to the agreement meeting their needs. The strait opened, the nuclear ambitions of Iran being circumscribed, as was happening during the negotiations, but immediate economic relief for the Iranians as well is something that could be put on the table there and allow this to go forward. But short of that, I would be surprised to see success.
Gina, how long do you think this is going to go on for?
Ooh, again, that tiger. The Iranians appear willing to absorb an enormous amount of hurt from the United States and Israel. We haven't yet seen internal fracturing in the leadership. The IRGC is well understood to be in charge and to be hardliners. Wherever they all are, they probably intend to stay. President Trump has a reputational burden for himself personally and for the United States. It is hard to walk away without a clear definition of a credible success for having started a war and meted the destruction, the loss of life. Was it worthwhile? That is the question he's going to have to answer to the American people, as well as our allies in the Gulf who have suffered and the rest of the world. Because of that, this could go in a low-intensity fashion. This could go on for a while.
What's a while?
Well, that I don't know. You know, if the Iranians continue to charge, if the president goes back to the Strait of Hormuz is not our problem, others will figure that out, or it'll open naturally as soon as we declare victory and walk away. Perhaps the Iranians will simply charge people and shipping will continue through. Many of the war aims and military aims have indeed been met by the, you know, the U.S. military. So yeah, there are elements where he could declare victory.
Okay, Gina, thank you very much. Putting you on the spot there, but, you know, you're one of the best people to ask about this. Gina Abercrombie Winstanley, thank you. Middle East expert, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and a former U.S. ambassador. You know, this is not a game. This is incredibly serious. And this, you know, this is affecting everyone. So I wonder what your estimation is out there of when this will end. You can get in touch with us, 87222, start your message with the word Times. When will it end and why do you think that? Let's stick with military affairs, because Donald Trump's repeated threats to leave NATO have spurred promises of increased defence spending in the UK. But the Times reports that plans to put British industry and infrastructure on a war footing have been delayed until at least next year. The Defence Readiness Bill has been left out of legislation plans for 2026. This is on the front page of the Times today. And let's speak to Ben Obsejecty, who's the Conservative MP for Huntingdon and a former British Army officer, of course. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Asma.
What was your reaction to this news?
It's disappointment, but it's certainly not a surprise. I think we've seen in recent weeks there's been endless talk about the Defence Investment Plan and the fact that that is yet to be published. And this is another aspect of what is a wider malaise that seems to be affecting the Ministry of Defence. The Defence Readiness Bill was announced last year by Lord Coker, who's one of the Labour Defence Ministers in the House of Lords, that it will be published in early 2026. We now find out today that it won't be in the King's Speech and that it will be pushed back into mid-2027 at the earliest. And this is a vital bill that needs to be laid before Parliament to ensure that the UK is on a war footing. It effectively enables industry to be militarised should the need arise. And given the current pressures and febrile geopolitical environment, it's crucial that this is laid before Parliament. Unfortunately, it ties back to a number of items that are now late. We've also seen that the Defence Finance Investment Strategy is due to be published in early 2026. There's no sign of that. The Defence Infrastructure Recapitalisation Plan was due in February. The government's already confirmed that they haven't had that put to them either. So there are a number of factors that the government is now dragging its heels on. And it talks a very, very good game about defence. But when push comes to shove and you start to scratch the surface, you see just how much our capability is found wanting.
From an outsider's point of view, it feels that everything is very chaotic, you know, because the Ministry of Defence and issues flowing from that, you know, to do with kit and procurement and everything. There haven't been any positive stories about that in a long time. And it feels like this is just a bit of a mess that perhaps needs a bit more time. But I mean, is that just an excuse?
It does need more time, and I think that's part of the problem. These are self-imposed deadlines from the government that they wanted to be seen to be acting quickly and on the front foot, and they found themselves to be incapable of meeting those deadlines. We know that there's potentially a quite a large funding gap, which is the reason that's holding up the Defence Investment Plan. I don't doubt that the Defence Secretary and the Defence Ministers want to get that out. I believe that it's the Treasury that is holding this back, because it simply won't put up the cash to deliver what's in the Strategic Defence Review. The government published an uncosted strategic defence review. It isn't affordable, and therefore the problem that we have now is that the Defence Investment Plan has been kicked around between the various services because nobody is willing to cut the capabilities that have been put forward in order to make this affordable and get it across the line. And it's going to be very, very interesting to see what is delivered versus what isn't from a huge, and I mean huge, list of capabilities that the armed forces requires, not only to make sure that it is able to deal with the threats we currently face, the demands laid out in the SDR.
Just on that, just finally, if we were to enter into a conflict, for example, say we're called in because the theoretical Ukraine peacekeeper force gets attacked, what would that mean for our armed forces as they stand today?
It's very unclear. I don't believe that we will be drawn into a boots on the ground combat situation in Ukraine. We have said that we would maintain an element of a peacekeeping force thereafter. I think that in itself, the 7,500 rumoured troops that will be put forward for that place a massive strain on the armed forces. To maintain a force of 7,500, you need three times that many, because by the second iteration, you'll have troops that have just returned, you'll have troops that are there, and you'll be troops that are preparing to go. So all in all, need around 22,000. That's over 50% of the current field army. And so that leaves us very, very stretched when it comes to maintaining any of our other commitments. We've seen that there's a conflict developing in the Middle East. We're also committed to protecting the High North. We've just committed the entirety of the Royal Marines to operating out of Norway to prevent the Russians from breaking out of the Kola Peninsula. So there are a number of factors that we are increasingly wedded and committed to, and the government is biting off more than it can chew. And unless it puts up an awful lot more money for defence, and that's more than the 2.5 that they promised to invest from starting from next year, we've already seen that we've dropped into the bottom third of NATO spending.
Ben Obsi-Jekti, thank you very much for talking to us. He's a Conservative MP for Huntington and, of course, also a former British Army officer. You can get in touch as well. Remember, 87222, start your message with the word Times. Coming up, how is what has been called the fattest town in Britain? How are they planning to slim down? It is 3:22.
Wake up to Britain's brightest business bulletins with Times Radio business correspondent Dominic O'Connell.
For the latest business news and what it means for your money, join me, Dominic O'Connell, throughout breakfast every morning from 6.
Get expert insight and analysis in one essential breakfast briefing, Business Bulletins, with Times Radio business correspondent Dominic O'Connell on Times Radio. It's the business.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
And if you normally listen to Times Radio at home, you can also listen in your car too. I'm sure you know that. If you've got a DAB radio in your car, you just need to search the dial for Times Radio. If you can't find it, you may need to rescan your radio, which doesn't take long at all. And then you can listen to us while you drive around. 3:24 now. This is Asma Mir in for Jane and Fee. In Ebbw Vale, long labelled Britain's fattest town, residents are pushing back against rising obesity and a high street dominated by takeaways, with nearly 80% of adults overweight in Blaenau Gwent. Councillors are considering banning junk food advertising and limiting new fast food outlets. Speaking on Times Radio Breakfast this morning, Councillor Helen Cunningham explained why she supports a ban.
Blaenau Gwent faces some significant challenges in terms of people have shorter healthy life expectancies and multiple health conditions. So that's a real challenge for us. And a lot of those conditions we know, we're a Marmot Council, and so we know that those conditions are preventable and there's something that can be done about them. So that's kind of how it came about, really. And there's other councils in Wales that have already done this. So considering where we are in Blaenau Gwent, I supported the motion on the basis that, you know, we have the opportunity to do this, so let's try it.
But locals say that poverty, cost of living pressures and lack of healthier options make change far from simple. Let's speak to Monica Price, who is a nutritionist. Hello to you, Monica.
Hello.
It does seem rather unfairly that, and I'm sure this is not the only place where this happens, but this particular community, they've got quite a lot kind of loaded against them. They've got a huge number of fast food outlets. There's junk advertising everywhere. And this is a place which is already where people already feel poverty quite keenly.
Yes.
Do you applaud what they're doing?
Well, I think it's a start, Asmir. I think, you know, the healthy weight, healthy Wales is the strategy for Wales. And I think, to be honest, the government are failing Wales. You know, some communities are better than other, but having worked in Wales and worked with the community, what I feel we're putting money into isn't working. We've done so many strategies, we've had so many reports, both of the reports, the big report, this one, the new strategy that's coming out in 2025, 2027, so it's already started, is already part of that. I was reading it today before I came to you, and it said resources are redirected to primary prevention to protect future generations. Well, already I feel that that's failing, and certainly things like banning advertisements and banning sugary drinks and things like that, the sugar levy, all of those things will help, but that doesn't bring about the community. And I think from the article in the Times today, it was very interesting to see the response of the community saying that they would like to see more healthier options. They would like to have restaurants. They don't want to have so many takeaways and fast food outlets, which, you know, according to that article in that particular town, it seems to be, you know, just trench with food takeaways. And of course, if you haven't got anything else, then that person is going to, those families are going to go to those restaurants. But I think it's all about education. You know, we're missing a trick here. We always seem to not look at what's happening to future generations. And we need to think about educating the communities, educating the children into cooking. You know, we've lost cooking skills, and that is extremely important when you're trying to help yourself lead a much healthier lifestyle.
That is all very true. I feel there are two things here. Number one, of course, education, cooking skills. You know, it would be good if there was some time in the curriculum for kids to learn about cooking. Absolutely. However, I think it is sometimes, but not always, the case that it is cheaper to eat pizzas, burgers, whatever, than proper healthy food. Because and also the two are tied up, because one takes effort.
Yeah.
And it's not, I don't think it's always a case of laziness. I think it's a case that people are incredibly busy. They work long days.
Yes, I agree with that.
And I just feel that if your high street is, let's just say your high street is 60% takeaways, what, I'm not quite sure what you're supposed to do.
I think what it is, I think what you have to remember is that health is the single most important thing that you can look after. And I think...
you're right, but why doesn't the high street reflect that then?
Exactly that. And that's where we're going wrong. That's a very good question. And it's one that we've more and more now, we're always concerned about our weight and we're always concerned about our health, because we are flooded with TV, radio, adverts, magazines, supplements, everything now. We're awash with how to live a much healthier lifestyle. So why is the obesity rate increasing? Why are we becoming a fat nation? The reason, I think, personally, is because we're not, yes, I think price comes into it. And I think that people are thinking that takeaways are cheaper and to cook a healthier meal is more expensive. Well, takeaways are really expensive. And I don't know how people afford to have a takeaway, for example, every single night of the week. But what we do know is that we have very cheap takeaways food in certain high streets.
Yeah.
So, of course, families who are struggling already are going to go to those local restaurants and have a takeaway food. But often when I was working with the parents, when I worked with the communities, they didn't want to. It's just they didn't know any better, which is why I think educating them about nutrition and the importance of nutrition and the importance of becoming overweight and obese and how it can lead to health conditions like heart disease, diabetes, blood pressure. So I think there's a gap missing. The government have put out all these strategies, but they haven't signposted well enough for people to actually access these services.
So just one final thing here. Council officials have been asked to stop granting permission to build drive-throughs and presumably also limiting the number of takeaways. So if the high street in Ebbervale was, fewer takeaways, more, places that sold fresh vegetables, you know, they were even bemoaning the lack of, you know, fresh butchers,
yes,
all that kind
butchers.
Of stuff. So if the high street changed because the council wanted it to change, do you honestly, hand on heart, think that would change people's habits?
I don't think it would change people's habits, but I think it would give them a choice. At the moment, I think lots of towns, they don't have a choice. And I think taking away that choice isn't fair. I think people should have the choice whether they want to eat healthily or eat unhealthily. You cannot force someone to eat healthily. But if you give them the choice and you educate them into understanding that actually what you eat, you are what you eat. That old-fashioned saying, you are what you eat, is actually very true. And if you educate them and give them an understanding that this is going to affect your body in this way, and if you eat the healthy food, this is going to eat your body in a much better way, then they have a choice. And I think that's what's lacking. It's us as consumers, we're lacking choices now in our high street.
Yeah, I think we can probably, most of us agree on that, there does seem to be a lack of a choice on some high streets. Monica, thank you. Very interesting.
Thank you.
Monica Price, who is a nutritionist. I wonder if you've read this piece in the Times today, how the fattest town in the country is trying to shape up. I would urge you to read the whole thing, actually, because, you know, they are talking about specific shops saying, you know, the butcher's is closed, this is closed. We really wish that they were there. Read the whole thing and then let me know what you think would actually change. 87222. Start your message with the Times, or you can WhatsApp 0333 0032353. Right, coming up, the World Coal Carrying Championship has just wrapped up. We're going to head to West Yorkshire to find out how it went with the race director. Who won? How long did they take? Did they drop the coal? I need to know. But first of all, we're going to get a check on the latest news headlines on Times Radio at 3:32 with James Kitchen.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Asma. Good afternoon. Iran says it won't open the Strait of Hormuz as part of a potential temporary ceasefare with the United States. The demands included in a proposal from Egyptian, Pakistani and Turkish mediators, which would reportedly pause fighting for 45 days. Donald Trump's threatened to blow up Iranian bridges and power plants if the shipping lane isn't reopened by tomorrow night. Here's Middle East commentator Tara Kangalu.
This is not just the United States' war on Iran, but also Israel very much is part of this effort. And so I do wonder how much the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is on the same page with Donald Trump.
Meanwhile, Israel's confirmed its forces have killed Iran's head of intelligence, Majid Hademi. The Israeli military has also attacked the country's South Pars gas complex. Ministers insist changes to the benefits system introduced today will help millions of workers. They include the right to statutory sick pay from the first day of illness and the scrapping of the two-child benefit cap. The Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, says Kanye West's recent anti-Semitism is disgusting, but she can't comment on whether or not he'll be granted a UK visa. Campaigners are demanding the rapper be blocked from performing at Wireless Festival this summer. Three men have been arrested on suspicion of murder after a man was attacked outside a bar in Bournemouth. The victim, who was in his 40s, died at the scene this morning. Four astronauts will reach depths of space later never experienced before. They'll also lose contact with Earth for around 40 minutes as they orbit round the far side of the moon. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on any podcast platform.
This is Times Radio.
You're listening to Times Radio, where conversation goes beyond the headlines. When it comes to advertising, is your business showing up in environments where it's taken seriously? Or are you relying on word of mouth alone? Join us at the Times Radio advertising event in May. You'll receive a custom campaign for your business, event-only prices, and free creative designed to reflect the quality of your brand. Register now at newsrsvp.co.uk/radio. Stop relying on word of mouth alone and start being heard.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions, to delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house,
and people who don't stack the dishwasher properly.
To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Right, it is 3:35, in case you're wondering. This is Asma Mir sitting in from now until Thursday for Jane and Fee. We are going to be doing all sorts of things. We're going to check in on the coal carrying championships, because this is important stuff. I really hope that you are on the edge of your edge of your seats. Who won? How long did it take? There's lots of different categories, you know, in the world championships. We're going to be doing that. First of all, we're going to talk about books, though, because it is time now to enter our literary salon. Just break off a bit of Easter egg, if you can face it and lie back. Robbie Millen is literary editor of The Times and The Sunday Times and joins us now. Hi, Robbie.
Hello there.
You never rest. You never stop reading.
No.
You are a hero of our times.
It's like money never sleeps. The book desk never sleeps.
I know it doesn't. I'm going to tell you about the book that I've been reading in a minute. And no one asked this, but we just managed to find out what it was called, you know, who the author was. Now, first of all, you've got two true crime books for us today.
Yeah, no, I'm feeling quite murderous at the moment.
Oh, so, another feeling.
The first one I might mention, which is out the second half of April, is called Murder in Paris 68, A True Story of Death and Glamour. And this took my fancy because on the cover, it's got Alain Delon.
Oh, come on.
You know, that beautiful... The actor is called the most beautiful man in the world. Mm. We can remember him for his role as Tom Ripley in Purple Noon, Plan Soleil, the original, the best, yes. Mr. Ripley. And it's a very strange true story of... He had a sort of bodyguard, come double man who was living with him. A Yugoslav guy who was murdered. His body was found wrapped in a plastic.
Gosh.
And it was a mystery. Well, did Alain Delon have something to do with this man's death? So this sort of book looks at this this whole case, which in the late 60s in France was a big deal because, I mean, obviously Alain Delon, anything to do with him was interesting.
Yeah.
But there all sorts of these stories started arising about kind of sex parties, sort of orgies with high-profile figures going, including supposedly Claude Pompidou, the wife of... Or Georges Pompidou, who was soon to be president of France, was prime minister at the time. So it turned into one of these big, really sleazy scandals that, but no one really has quite understood what happened. No one ever actually got convicted of this murder. Mm. And it's a very strange, because you think, what was Alain Delon? He had this lovely mansion in Paris. Yes. What was this man doing living in his place? There were rumors, oh, was Alain Delon gay? Were they lovers? So it's one of those really intriguing stories where first we get a murder mystery, but then you get a kind of portrait of France in the 60s and into the 70s when you realise how many of the senior politicians were very close to organised crime, because a lot of senior politicians had served in the resistance, and organised crime in its own way had been fighting the Gestapo.
Yeah.
So they all these strange alliances.
And I'm really interested, does the book explain how this was dealt with at the time and how that might, you know, how that might differ to today? Was it kind of hushed up?
There was a lot of subterfuge. So Edward Chisholm, who wrote the book, spends a lot of time going through these archives in Paris, where all of a sudden things were still redacted, bits of, you know, it was very difficult to get information out. And I think under each new, whoever got into power, this case would either usually be buried further and further and further down. I mean, it could have just been that the person that was murdered was trying to blackmail Alain Delon, and Alain Delon had criminal friends who just thought, oh, we'll do Alain, he's a beautiful guy, we'll do him a favour.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, obviously, some we get a bit carried away, don't we, with these true crime things, because someone did die.
Yes, no, exactly.
It's you know, that is an incredibly sad story for the family involved. Also, in the next book that you want to talk about, this is London Falling, A Mysterious Death in a Gilded City and a Family Search for Truth. Tell us about this.
And this is by an author called Patrick Radden Keefe, who's a New Yorker writer. So essentially anything this guy writes, I want to read.
Okay.
He wrote a terrific book a few years back called Say Nothing, which again was another sort of true crime story, but it was about the murder of Jean McConville.
Mm.
Do you remember? Yes. The story's bubbled along for many years. She was murdered by the IRA in 1972. She was a mother of 10. Mm. It's always been a bit of mystery why she was murdered. Had she been informing on the IRA or whatever? But for a long time, her body was never found. The body was kept hidden. But Pat Radden Keefe did a great investigative job finding out exactly what had happened. So, I mean, that was a terrific book, which won the Orwell Prize for political writing. And then a few years ago, he wrote Empire of Pain, again, another piece of brilliant investigative writing, all about the Sackler family, who owned, or bits of it owned, Purdue Pharma, and their role in the OxyContin crisis. And again, this family made, well, bits of the family, I think, there's probably lawyers listening, made huge amounts of money, essentially flogging what was called hillbilly heroin to amongst the poorest people in America. So anything he writes, I'm interested in. And again, I'm only halfway through this one, but this is terrific because it's quite a complicated case. It involves a teenager called Zach Brettler, a London teenager, in 2019, fell to his death in his apartment block next to the Thames. And he's trying to pick together what led him to this moment when he fell. Mm-hmm. And it's a story about he started... got into a head that he wanted to... He was a bit of a fantasist. He loved the idea of being around the super rich. And he made up this backstory for himself where he pretty much pretended he was the son of a Russian oligarch.
Goodness me.
So he was kind of hanging out in these super...
Was this a social media aspect to this as well?
Well, I think this was more kind of face-to-face networking. Okay. So he was sort of getting into these rather posh kind of Mayfair clubs and things where he fell in with a couple of guys who were... Let's call them, because again, legally it's quite contentious. Mm. People who were perhaps a little bit dodgy,
right,
were trying to find ways of making money, and they thought we found this terrific mark. This guy who is clearly very rich. I mean, he's son of an oligarch. How can we get hold of some money? So it's a bit about that. This kind of milieu of London. You know, it's a portrait of London. Loads of dark money floating around, but it's also about. This boy's parents and the kind of anguish they were in trying to find out what happened when essentially so many of the doors were closed, because it's still a case sort of shrouded in mystery. Mm. But Patrick Radenkey, he's sort of brilliant writer. He sort of takes you by the hand and lets the story slowly unwind at a good pace.
I think what I find really fascinating about this genre, and it's not one that I've read, but you've very much sold it to me, is just how, you know, you don't get an answer at the end necessarily of these books.
No, exactly.
And yet, because of the research and the archive and the detail and the storytelling... Is that what works?
Yeah. So I think with the one about Alain Delon murder in Paris 68, it's kind of really a portrait of France under a sort of period of change in the 60s. I mean, you've got all these new beautiful characters coming from nowhere. Alain Delon was a poor lad, sort of being sort of catapulted into our eyes by the kind of power of cinema. Likewise, with this London falling, it's kind of a trying to get a sense of a city kind of with this sort of money from all over the world sloshing around. And where there's money, there's always crime, because there's always bad people who want more.
Indeed. So I'm just going to say what the books are again. So it's Murder in Paris 68, A True Story of Death and Glamour by Edward Chisholm. And the next one was London Falling, A Mysterious Death in a Gilded City and A Family Search for Truth. That's a very long title. Yeah. By Patrick Radden Keefe. I just quickly want to mention, because we were just discussing this, a bit of a reader's block, which I know you never have that. So I'm reading the very thin novels right now. And one that I read recently, just over the last couple of days, and I couldn't wait to get back to it, was A Family Matter by Claire Lynch, which won the Nero Book Award Gold Prize last year. Yeah. If you, like me, love the nostalgia kind of the 80s, this is an amazing book for that, because it conjures up the 80s and actually the cruelty that people, the way that people dealt with each other actually back then. This is about a divorce and a child staying with a dad and the mum being sent away because she was a lesbian.
Yeah.
Which feels unbelievable, but a lot of this stuff uses kind of court reporting and stuff from the time. And it is amazing to think that in this quite recent past that this happened. And, you know, Claire, she just really, really captures the era so, so well. And it's just one of those books, it's a kind of book I haven't read in a long time where I just could not wait to get back to it. So there is hope for all of us. If you've got a bit of a reader's block right now, can I suggest that you pick yourself a thin novel of about 200 pages? Maybe we should do that actually as a regular feature, the reader's block book.
No, exactly.
And make sure you read that.
But if you want certain 80s vibe,
I do.
You might enjoy Jenny Godfrey's The Barbecue at Number 9.
Okay, yes. Because I've seen that in bookshops.
Yeah, it's sort of doing very well. It's a novel sort of set in one kind of normal kind of new build estate in the 80s.
Yeah.
And it's one family having a barbecue there. Mm. It's Live Aid is on in the background. It's kind of a Live Aid one. And you get all the families, the stories of the people on the close,
Love
what they've been up to. and it ends in a dark place.
Does it? How many pages are in it? That's what I want to know. I'm only joking.
More than 300, I think.
I will manage it. Robbie, thank you so much. Always love to hear from you. Robbie Millen, literary editor of The Times and The Sunday Times. Have you got any good book recommendations, especially if you've got a bit of reader's block, then you can get in touch and let us know what they are. We can share them with the listeners. 87222, start your message with the word Times. Right, coming up, how far would you carry a sack of coal? Plus money matters and those pesky one-star reviews, all the rest of that from the Times. It is 3:47.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Need anything from Tesco? Like a delicious whole leg of lamb. Or a succulent large beef roasting joint. Now, even better than half price this Easter with your Tesco club card. Because every little helps. Majority of larger stores and online ends 10th of April. Club card or app required. Exclusions apply.
Happy Meal just got a cosmic boost. Because the Super Mario Galaxy movie has landed in cinemas. And Mario hasn't come alone. There's a whole galaxy for your little ones to discover. Some fun, some food. It's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 4th of May, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last.
Experience. It's knowing the difference between a good deal and, well, a great deal. That's why right now you can get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. You get 24/7 GP access whenever you want it. And the freedom to choose your preferred private hospital with your own room should you need it. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Now, quite a few of you got in touch, just before we go to Money Matters, about the story in the Times today about the fattest town in the country. This is Ebbervale, how the fattest town in the country is trying to shape up. And residents in the article talk about the fact that there are so many takeaway shops and that all the independent shops, the butchers, etc., have closed down. But Gary's got in touch to say Ebbervale has an Aldi and a Tesco in the town. I'm afraid that government cannot enforce healthy eating on a population that has the option but doesn't have the desire. Another one here from Alan. This is incredibly patronising. The people you're talking about make a conscious decision to eat out or get takeaways. They know about the health issue, nutrition and five a day, and that is their choice. It is a bad choice, but it is still a choice. Helen says the work of Jamie Oliver, Joe Wicks and loads of online cheap, healthy recipes. What more education do you need? But Jan says when both parents work, it is bound to make cooking from scratch more difficult. It is bound to. Right, it is now 3:49. They say it takes 20 years to build a reputation and just 5 minutes to destroy it. In today's digital world, a handful of clicks on Google can shape the fate of a business overnight. One dental practice in the south of England has found itself under attack, hit by a surge of fake one-star reviews, allegedly from a targeted scammer in Bangladesh. Let's speak to Megan Harwood-Baines, senior money reporter with The Times and The Sunday Times. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
So just take us through what's happened to this poor dental practice.
Sure. So they basically woke up one morning and in the space of an hour, they'd had about seven one-star reviews. They're a fairly small dental practice, so they didn't have, you know, thousands of reviews already. So because of that very quick low proportion of reviews, it took their rating from 5 stars down to 4.7, which doesn't sound like a lot. But when you're sort of an independent practice trying to win businesses, you know, any sort of small change can make a huge difference. So when they looked at the reviews, they went through all the names, tried to see, you know, what patients they saw, try and work out what had gone wrong. None of the names left by the reviewers matched anyone that they'd seen. Mm. And when they clicked on the profiles, they saw that within the Google picture, there was a phone number saying, contact me. And it was a Bangladeshi phone number. And then they clicked on the profiles again, and they saw that these same accounts had left other reviews on independent dental practices across the UK. There were some in Sheffield, some in London, all saying basically the same thing. Very convincing reviews, written very convincingly. The English was very good. And all of them were, you know, saying, contact me and I'll take this review down. The implication being, if you pay me, I'll take this review down.
Goodness me. So how did they respond?
So they were quite lucky in a sense that they've got quite a good social media following. They've got a very loyal fan base. And the patients all went on to Google and reported the reviews. So I think about 100 of their patients went on, reported these reviews to Google. And so Google took them down. But I have spoken to other business owners who say, you know, they've contacted Google about these reviews and absolutely nothing has happened. So one guy, he ended up tracking down the scammer himself. So he sort of used reverse image search. He was contacted by this WhatsApp number. A guy essentially said, you know, unless you pay me, I'll leave you a bad review every day. I'll just keep creating accounts and I'll keep leaving you bad reviews. So he ended up tracking the guy down. I'm not sure I would recommend engaging with the scammers like he did, but he tracked him down and was commenting under this guy's personal Facebook photos, screenshots of this saying, you know, this guy's a scammer. And in the end, the scammer agreed, you know, if you stop posting on my Facebook page, I'll stop posting on your Google page. And that's how we got it resolved. But Google didn't do anything to help him in that process.
You know how you said earlier that the reviews were, you know, they're written in like perfect English and they all seemed quite believable, presumably. I mean, do we know whether how much AI is helping with this kind of stuff or how much AI is facilitating these kind of things?
Yeah, so I spoke to one expert who said AI is definitely making it worse because AI can in seconds craft a very convincing review. And they all said the same things, you know, the wait time was too long, the dentist was too abrupt with me, the service wasn't what I expected. And they all said that classic thing of I'd never normally leave bad reviews. But in this case, you know, I felt I had to say something. So this scam is in sort of its infancy because the amounts being asked for aren't a huge amount in the grand scheme of things. It's a couple hundred pounds. So for many businesses, if they're not hearing from Google, they might think, well, you know, for the sake of £200 to get my rating back up, it might be worth paying. The problem is when you then pay these scammers, it builds a viable business. So at the moment, it might just be, you know, a couple of guys on a computer somewhere else in the world. If other scammers see, well, hold on a minute, they're making money from this, it then builds this huge industry, which we've seen with scam factories in the past.
What is the kind of advice then on, because you said that Google wouldn't necessarily help. What is the advice then? What should you do? I mean, obviously you don't take people on, you don't try and confront them, but what can you do if you, you know, don't have that kind of loyal base, customer base that you were talking about?
It's really tricky and it is hard for those smaller businesses who aren't able to almost get Google to notice. I mean, you can, as part of your business insurance now, there is an option to tag on like ransomware. So sometimes your insurers will help because it is a growing threat. Ransomware and cybercrime is a huge problem in the UK. So it's definitely worth looking into your insurance policy. But I would definitely say don't engage with the scammers because you don't want to give them a way in, particularly for this dental practice. They, from the off, said, you know, we're not going to engage with them. We can't risk getting hacked because if you then get hacked and your patient's data gets leaked, it makes the problem so much worse. But I think it's also on consumers to not be so reliant on getting our recommendations from AI and, you know, being a bit more critical when we look at Google reviews when we're sort of shopping around for services.
One other thing, Megan, you have also been writing about which generation is worst off financially. This feels like an argument that we just have every day on the radio. Who do you think then, or who does your research lead you to think might have it worst?
Yeah, this is not going to make me very popular, but I spent last week looking at the data of which generation had it worst. And this isn't to say which generation like worked the hardest or, you know, I'm not saying any generation has had it easy. We've all had different challenges. But the data does suggest that the baby boomers grew up in a time where it was, in a sense, the economy was sort of built up. You can tell I'm being very careful with my language.
Yes, I can.
So I don't get all of your viewers writing in, but they did sort of come of age, you know, into their sort of 20s and 30s in a time where it was easier to sort of buy a house, you know, wages, the proportion of wages to house prices was significantly better than it is today. And that's not something that has sort of carried on for the, you know, millennials and the Gen Z.
Which do you think is the kind of, which is the factor that matters most?
I think it all comes down to housing. I think housing is at the heart of every generational gripe that these younger generations have, because if you can't afford housing, then you don't feel like you can have a family. You don't feel like you can get married. You don't feel like you've got that kind of freedom to, you know, take a different job or do any of that. And I think if we have more affordable housing, or if it's easier for younger generations to get on the housing ladder, you know, it's not just the deposit, it's the sheer amount that houses cost. You know, you're borrowing six, sometimes seven times or whatever it is of your salary. And that's, you know, 40-year mortgages. You know, when I signed up for my mortgage, I had to tick a box saying I had a pension so I could pay my mortgage into retirement. And as a result, I was able to take out that mortgage, because the time frame, the terms are much longer these days. So I think it all comes down to housing. And I think if we sort of fix that for younger generations, a lot of other things will fall into place.
Yeah. Megan, thank you for that. It's really interesting. That's Megan Harwood Baines, senior money reporter with The Times and The Sunday Times. We were trying to get in touch with the World Coal Carrying Championship, because I mentioned it many, many times, but we haven't been able to, probably because they're very busy giving out medals or something like that. But we did talk there about pensions and pensioners. And I just want to flag this up. This is the Story podcast. Thousands of pensioners invested their life savings into London Capital and Finance, a company which promised big returns, which was later revealed to be the UK's biggest ever Ponzi scheme. So how was the scheme on the scale allowed to take root in the first place? Today's The Story podcast looks at that in depth. And Manveen Rana has been speaking to The Sunday Times contributing editor Jim Armitage.
You've recently managed to find out a bit more about this scheme. Tell us what you've learned.
So these hundreds at first, then thousands of investors who were investing in LCF, they were originally getting the interest that they were promised, that 8% interest. But far from the interest coming from the many brilliant small businesses that their money was being invested in, what was actually happening was that the money that they were getting back was coming from new investors' money. That is what's known as a Ponzi scheme or a pyramid scheme, where your original investors are paying for the interest for the new investors. Many, many, many millions of pounds allegedly ended up in the personal bank accounts of the men at the centre of this.
Right, that was the Sunday Times contributing editor Jim Armitage speaking to Manveen Rana, and they were talking about all the pensioners invested their life savings into London Capital and Finance. It's a really interesting story. Thank you so much today. I'll be back tomorrow. But thanks for all your texts and your tweets. Alistair, I'm fed up hearing about busy lives being an excuse for poor eating. People are no busier now than they were before, and they have so many more gadgets that make things easier. They just can't be bothered making an effort when there's an easier option. Stop making excuses, says Alistair. And on book recommendations, John from East Kilbride, all of the Montalbano novels, 27 in all, are around 200 pages, beautifully written by Andrea Camilleri. So there you go. Those are some recommendations if you have reader's block. That's it from me. Back tomorrow, coming up next, Drive with Carol Walker.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
It's 4 o'clock. I'm Carol Walker in for John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. The headlines: Iran has accused the US of destroying the path to diplomacy and warned that ceasefire negotiations are incompatible with ultimatums and threats to commit war crimes. And facial recognition drones will be used in the Channel to try to catch people smugglers, The Times has learned. Coming up on the programme, The Times Middle East correspondent Samer Al-Atrush and Mohd Yousif, a former national security advisor of Pakistan, give me the latest on the conflict in the Middle East and the efforts to get negotiations going.
This is Times Radio.
First, though, let's get the latest headlines from James Kitchen.
Thank you, Carol. Good afternoon. In the past few minutes, Donald Trump has said Iran is not too strong at all. The country has accused the US of destroying the path to diplomacy, warning any ceasefire negotiations are incompatible with ultimatums and threats to commit war crimes. It's understood Tehran and Washington have received a two-tier plan to end the war compiled by Pakistan. President Trump has threatened to strike Iranian critical infrastructure and blow up the whole country if the regime failed to open the Strait of Hormuz by tomorrow evening. Former U.S. Ambassador Gina Abercrombie Winstanley told Times Radio the president is betraying signs of frustration.
The Chinese have a saying about riding the tiger. It's easier to get on than to get off. And certainly, I believe both sides might be experiencing this. We cannot underestimate the pressure that is on the Iranian regime, the destruction that is being meted out on the country, on its leadership, on its military and industrial capabilities. Both sides are facing pressure.
The Times has revealed facial recognition software will be deployed on drones in the Channel to help prosecute people smugglers organizing migrant crossings. Border Force is trialling military-grade radar-enabled cameras that can identify individuals up to half a mile away, regardless of whether they've changed outfits or appearance. Almost 4,000 migrants have crossed so far this year. That's down 28% compared with the same period last year. The number of women dying during pregnancy while in labour or soon after giving birth is at its highest level for two decades. An investigation by The Times reveals the NHS was given 67 separate warnings between 2013 and 2023. Over the same decade, the UK's maternal death rate rose by half, with 257 women dying in the 2 years until 2023. A number of benefits and the state pension are rising as the new financial year begins, including more funding for larger families on universal credit. The two-child benefit cap has now been scrapped, meaning some 480,000 families with three or more children will receive an average rise of £4,100 a year. HuffPost political editor Kevin Schofield says the changes may placate rebellious Labour backbenchers for now.
The talk of removing Keir Starmer after the elections in May, that seems to have died away a little bit. I think perhaps partly because of the geopolitical situation, a lot of Labour MPs now think it would just be the wrong time to try and change prime ministers when things are so up in the air around the world. He is seen as being more comfortable, certainly on the global stage.
Four astronauts are just hours away from reaching a part of space never explored before. The crew of Artemis 2 will be flying past the dark side of the moon at around 11:45 tonight UK time. James Carpenter is from the European Space Agency.
Ultimately, the plan is to be able to ferry people to the moon very regularly on a safe basis. And who knows, perhaps even tourists will be fortunate one day to visit the moon. And of course, we would like that to be safe, just as air travel is today.
For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times Radio News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow.
A very good afternoon to you and welcome to the programme. Carol Walker in for John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive this Easter Monday. Pakistan is trying to broker a ceasefire as President Trump prepares to deliver an update on the war in Iran. All eyes will be on the president after he faced a backlash for the language of his Truth Social warning to Iran to open the Strait of Hormuz to shipping or face attacks on its bridges and power plants. A social media post full of expletives does not sound to me like a leader who's confident of his position, despite the success of US Special Forces who pulled off that dramatic rescue of a US airman from behind enemy lines. Well, we'll bring you the president's news conference live after 6 o'clock this evening. We'll find out more about Pakistan's role with Mohid Yousaf, who's a former national security adviser to the government there. And in an hour's time, I'll be speaking to the former State Department official, Karen von Hippel, and to a US Marine Corps veteran, Jonathan Hackett. Also on the programme tonight, we'll find out about plans to use facial recognition from drones to tackle people smugglers in the Channel. I'll be speaking to the Labour MP for Britain's fattest town to hear about the efforts to counter high levels of obesity. And at 6 o'clock in Carol and Friends, I'm delighted to be joined by Kitty Donaldson, Chief Political Commentator at The Eye, and Rachel Cunliffe, Associate Political Editor of The New Statesman. And of course, we love to hear from you. Do get in touch with us. Text 87222, tweet us on X at Times Radio, email studio@times.radio, or send us a WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. Israel has been striking key energy and power plants in Iran, including the South Pars National Gas Field. Meanwhile, it's reported that the US and Iran have received a ceasefire plan from Islamabad to end hostilities and fully open the Strait of Hormuz to shipping. President Trump has been speaking at an Easter event at the White House in the last few minutes.
I just want to say we have a great military. We're the greatest military, the most powerful military any place in the world.
Well, let's speak to Samer Al-Atrush, the Times Middle East correspondent. Good afternoon to you, Samer.
Hello.
It does sound as though both sides in this war have been really keeping up their attacks and counterattacks, even while Pakistan is trying to broker a ceasefire.
Yes, I think from the Iranian point of view, they believe that they have the upper hand. They feel that the US and Israel went into this conflict badly underestimating their capabilities. After perhaps 3 years almost of signs of weakness from the Iranian regime. What they're trying to set out to do here is that they want to restore their regional deterrence. They have a bunch of maximalist demands. I don't think they're in the mood for compromise. So,